This is Audible.
There is a quote from a young man who spent some time in Williamsburg during the American Civil War. His name was Captain David Cronin. Well-educated and with a keen eye for the historic buildings of the old capital. He said, "An air of venerable prestige pervades the town, and this will always render it attractive and inspiring to lovers of history." Welcome to Colonial Williamsburg, and welcome to Bright Path Tours. This is part one of a tour that will take us through the entire area that was the old capital city. The Colonial Williamsburg that we see today is a reconstruction of the thriving town as it existed during the 1700s, the time it served as the capital of Colonial Virginia. We're beginning this tour at one of the historic and very important taverns that served the town, Christina Campbell's. Christina Campbell's Tavern is on Waller Street, directly across from the old capital. From there, we're walking down the north side of Duke of Gloucester Street to our final stop at the Governor's Palace. Of the 88 restored buildings in town on this tour, we'll see a number of the most picturesque and important buildings that served the colonial population. Before we begin, there are just a couple of reminders I'd like to offer. First, watch your step. The sidewalks are mostly paved with brick, and they can be uneven and slippery. The original colonial town would not have had these nice brick sidewalks. They were someone's idea of how the town should look. Many visitors prefer to walk in the road, which has its own hazards, namely the horses and horse-drawn carriages. If you happen to end up behind one of those, do be careful and watch where you're stepping. Also, since we're walking from one building to another, many of the stops will be close together, so at any point you can have a seat on one of the many benches. You'll never be far from the current stop. First up on our tour is Christina Campbell's Tavern, which is on Waller Street, across the street from the Capitol, and just beyond the Capitol grounds. As you make your way there, I'd like to give you a little history of this town. If you're there already, please feel free to have a seat nearby, but not at the tavern itself, as it may be open for business. Before Williamsburg became the capital, this place was known as Middle Plantation. Middle Plantation was just that, a plantation at the midpoint between the James and York Rivers. Keep in mind that there were few roads here during the early years of the colony, and the roads that did exist could be hazardous or downright dangerous for travelers. That made nearby rivers an important and desirable mode of transportation and trade. In 1699, after a series of disasters in the original capital of Jamestown, the decision was made to move the seat of government to a more habitable, convenient location, and that location was Middle Plantation. It was a good move. For the next 80 years, the town would prosper, but most important, it would be a witness to some of early America's most important social and political actions. It would see the growth of America's second oldest college. It would establish one of the oldest parishes in the country and would host many of the founding fathers of American democracy. Williamsburg was at the center of the maelstrom that gave us our democratic republic, and you've come here to see the places that represent the beginning. Luckily for you, those places have been faithfully and accurately restored so that you can literally step back in time. But if it weren't for the action of one tenacious resident and one wealthy, powerful industrialist, there would be no Colonial Williamsburg. Towards the end of the Revolutionary War, in 1780, the capital moved again, this time further inland to the established town of Richmond, Virginia. With that move, the city of Williamsburg lost its luster and its purpose, and the decline began. The once vibrant colonial city would slide into obscurity. Its buildings would burn, or they would remain empty and neglected, or they would simply age to the point of collapse. For the next 150 years, the city would sink to the level of a sleepy old southern town. And then, incredibly, it would be resurrected in one of the greatest reclamations, reconstructions, and restorations America has ever seen. Enter William Archer Rutherford Goodwin and John D. Rockefeller. In the early 1930s, these men came together, and before they built a town, they built a small army of researchers, architects, historians, and advisors, all of whom would lend a hand in planning this massive restoration. And massive it is. The historic area of Colonial Williamsburg would come to encompass some 300 acres, 88 original, restored buildings, and over 400 reconstructions, all so that we visitors can have a true window into the founding of our nation. The first view we'll have through that window will be one of the earliest and most important businesses to be established in town, the tavern. And the tavern we're visiting is Christina Campbell's. By now, you should be at Mistress Campbell's establishment, but if you're not there yet, please pause the tour until you arrive at Christina Campbell's Tavern. Christina Campbell's is a very popular tavern today, and was one of the most popular during the colonial era. With that in mind, please be aware that this is a working establishment, so remain on the sidewalk or have a seat on one of the benches near the tavern. As you approach this site, I'm sure you noticed its prominent location, right across from the Capitol. If you think this was prime property back then, you would be 100% correct. Christina Burdett was born in the early 1720s and grew up here in Williamsburg. Her father was a tavern keeper who ran Burdett's Ordinary. Ordinary is another term for a tavern, and you'll pass that building on this tour. It's marked with the sign of a castle. Being born into a tavern-keeping family, from the time she was a young girl, Christina helped with the family business, learning the various skills needed to run a successful tavern. First of all, she had to learn to cook and keep house, two skills that many young girls would learn anyway. But she also learned the business of tavern-keeping, ordering food and supplies, keeping the accounts, dealing with suppliers, advertising, and directing the slaves. She learned well. Christina's father died in 1746, leaving her 300 pounds, three slaves, and making her, at age 26, the executor of his estate. Christina appears to have been a very capable young woman. Around the time of her father's death, she was married to apothecary Ebenezer Campbell. They lived in nearby Blandford, Virginia, and by the early 1750s, they had two daughters. The younger of the two was also named Ebenezer, or Ebby, and was born around 1752, but sadly, we know that she was born after her father's death. Within a year, Christina had moved her family back to Williamsburg and embarked on her long career as a tavern keeper in Williamsburg, a career that would last almost 30 years. When you consider the era and the fact that there were few acceptable opportunities for women to earn an income of their own, you gain an appreciation for Christina's good business sense. The words woman and professional were rarely spoken in the same sentence unless it was in some derogatory reference. So the fact that Christina did not inherit her business from her husband or family, but instead built it on her own as a licensed tavern keeper, is a remarkable feat. She appears to have run her business at a couple of different locations near the Capitol during the 1750s and 60s. But by October of 1771, we find Christina advertising in the local paper, the Virginia Gazette, the opening of her tavern in the house behind the Capitol. 1771. Let's think about that for a minute. This is the time of great social and political turmoil in the colonies that would see the rise of the group that would become known as our Founding Fathers, many of whom met right here at Christina Campbell's. In this location, one of the closest to the capital, Mistress Campbell became witness to the discussions, actions, and rhetoric that would lead to the American Revolution. Men who would become the giants of American independence stayed here and dined here. Jefferson rented rooms at the Ordinary, and George Washington noted in his diary that he dined here more than 10 times over a 2-month period. By law, having a license to run an ordinary or tavern, Mistress Campbell was required to provide meals, drink, and rooms at prices set by the local court. The prices were set in order to ensure that the lower classes could have an affordable place to stay or to eat. But this industrious woman desired to attract a higher class patron, and to do that, she advertised her business as a place of genteel accommodations and the very best entertainment. Knowing that balls and dances, known as assemblies, were very popular with that genteel society, she allowed the local Masonic Lodge to hold balls here. Even though Campbell owned and ran her business, she certainly could not have taken care of all the day-to-day chores related to tavern keeping. For that, she depended on her enslaved labor. She would have had a cook who would have been kept very busy. This cook must have been quite skilled because the tavern was well known for its delicious meals. She would have needed multiple people, including children, to help with laundry, cleaning, and kitchen chores. Stable hands were required to help with the horses of all sorts of travelers, from the well-heeled gentry to the lower-class tradesmen, and perhaps those same slaves would help with fetching food and supplies from the surrounding plantations and farms. In the 1770s, however, we also see that Christina sent some of her slaves to the Bray School, a local school that taught enslaved and free black children to read and write, learn arithmetic, and study religion and social graces. In a society where many women were illiterate, this is a remarkable opportunity. The tavern thrived during the years leading up to the Revolutionary War, but during the war years, as you might imagine, shortages of everything made life difficult, and since she needed supplies in larger quantities than the normal household, Campbell's business suffered. Also, by the late 1770s, the decision had been made to move the Virginia capital yet again. So in 1780, Richmond is now the center of government. The move was not only the beginning of the end for Williamsburg, but it was the closing chapter for Christina Campbell and her tavern. Although she appears to have boarded college students from William and Mary for a time, in the late 1780s, Mistress Campbell moved away and joined her now married daughter, Ebby, in Fredericksburg, where she died in 1792. The tavern burned in the late 1850s, a final demise in a town that was itself falling into obscurity. But in the 1950s, during the resurrection of the capital city, Christina Campbell's tavern was rebuilt and regained its stature and its rightful place in the history of the town. I think you'll agree that it is fitting that the tavern has retained the name of the incredible woman who saw history unfold at the doorstep of her famous establishment. Our next stop is the home of another illustrious citizen in town who just happened to be the neighbor of Christina Campbell. His name was Benjamin Powell. Facing the tavern, turn left and walk about 100 feet up Waller Street. It will be the third house on your right, next door to the Benjamin Powell office. Benjamin Powell was an undertaker. But an undertaker at that time had a completely different meaning from what we know today. You will not find a funeral parlor here at the Powell House. Instead, as an undertaker, Benjamin Powell undertook contracts to build things. It appears that Powell was one of many tradespeople who lived in this part of town, the area that had been owned and developed by Benjamin Waller in the mid-1700s. Similar to other homes in town, the Powell homestead includes a number of support buildings. You'll see that the kitchen is detached, as was the custom at the time. This kept cooking smells, and most important, the possibility of fire, away from the main house. Benjamin Powell arrived in Williamsburg sometime around 1753. We know that because he recorded the baptism of his daughter Hannah at the local church, Bruton Parish Church, in 1753. At first, he purchased a plot of land nearby, but by 1763, he has purchased this property for a total of £75. Let me point out that the building that we see today is not the original building that was here at the time Powell purchased the property. The earlier building was much smaller and had the requisite outbuildings that probably included an early kitchen. The collection of buildings we're visiting dates from sometime after the mid-1760s through the mid-1800s. At the time of his first purchase, Powell was recorded as a wheelwright, someone who made and repaired wooden wheels that might be used on carts or carriages. He was also known as a carpenter and as a house joiner. A house joiner is the person who works on the details of a home, things like windows, mantelpieces, doors, those things that are joined to a house. By the year 1782, however, after the Revolution, Mr. Powell now uses the description gentleman. By then, he was Williamsburg's most successful carpenter and by then was undertaking building contracts. Powell's talents as a builder can be found in some of the prominent buildings around Williamsburg. Between the years 1764 through 1771, he worked on buildings such as the public jail, on Bruton Parish Church, adding the steeple there, and the Capitol. In 1771, he was given the contract to build the public hospital. The Revolutionary War brought additional prosperity when Powell was hired to provide equipment and other supplies for troops quartered here in Williamsburg. For that, he was paid £590. Benjamin Powell is a great example of what we today would call upward mobility, showing us that not everyone in colonial times was stuck in the class into which they were born. By 1767, he became a member of the Williamsburg City Council. In 1774, Benjamin Powell, gentleman, became a member of the Committee of Williamsburg, a committee that included such other gentlemen and famous residents as George Wythe and Peyton Randolph. The Powell House and its buildings were restored in 1955 and 1956. The many beautiful buildings in town make it difficult to picture what the old, decrepit town looked like in the early 1900s, and the Powell House is a good example. When the restoration began, the house had a full second story and a two-story veranda or porch attached to the front that needed to be torn down to return the home to its colonial-era design. If you were here at the time it was torn down, you would have seen a very different home. Very little of what you see on the outside is original, with the exception of some of the windows and an outside door on the back side of the house. All other elements were rebuilt during the 1955 restoration. We'll leave Mr. Powell now and move on to a house that is both old and new, the Coke Garrett House. To get there, turn left onto Nicholson Street, which is the street that runs right into Waller, just past the Powell House. You'll see the Coke Garrett House, the large white house on your right, after you turn onto Nicholson. While we're walking to the Coke Garrett House, I'd like to discuss the terms rebuild or reconstruction versus restoration. Around town, you'll see these descriptions on many of the buildings. As I mentioned at the beginning of the tour, There are 88 buildings that make up the core of the restored town. The difference between a rebuild or a restoration depends on the existence of the foundation and elements of the building. If the original foundations are gone, the building required a reconstruction. However, if the original foundation remains, or if parts of the building could be salvaged, we have a restoration. The Coke Garrett House is a restoration, although one portion has survived from the 1700s. As you approach the site, you can see that the home is in sections, sort of like a telescope, and those sections mark specific periods of the house's history. Please note that although you can certainly observe the house from the sidewalk, keep in mind that the building is a private home and not normally open to the public. But from the sidewalk, you can see the entire building. If you stand directly in front of the house, you see that there is a left section with a covered porch, then the two-story center building, another small building to the right, and then a brick office at the end of the house. In 1755, successful goldsmith and tavern keeper John Coke, who already owned three lots here, added on to the property with the purchase of two additional lots. He paid £32 for those two additional lots, by the way, and that's where he built the left section, sometime in the late 1750s, making that portion the oldest surviving structure on the property. When Coke died in 1767, his wife ran a tavern here for some time. The property changed hands during the latter half of the 18th century, and then, in 1810, the Garrett family acquired the whole site. By the late 1830s, the Garretts had built the larger two-story center section, and around the same time, they added the east wing, which is just to the right of the center section. That smaller wing was moved to the property from another location. Interestingly, the brick office at the far right of the property predates both of those buildings, so the two bookends of this structure are actually the oldest. Dr. Robert Garrett, a surgeon, owned the property by 1838 and used the brick office as his surgery. During the Civil War, Dr. Garrett treated soldiers here from both Union and Confederate armies after the Battle of Williamsburg that was fought in this area in 1862. Besides being a surgeon, Dr. Garrett also served as the mayor of Williamsburg as well as the superintendent of the public hospital, one of the buildings built by Benjamin Powell that sits at the other end of town. Take a close look at the brick office, and you'll see that the bricks make an interesting pattern. The way the bricks were placed creates the design known as Flemish bond, and it's a decorative 18th century style that we'll see throughout the town. The Garrett family owned this property until it was acquired by Colonial Williamsburg in 1927. Restoration began in 1928, and work continued in 1932 and was completed by 1961. Before we move on to the jail, there's one architectural element that I should point out. Note the porch on the left side, the west wing, and take a look at the railing. The railing is in the Chinese Chippendale style, a trellis design that was very popular during the 1700s. The rail is a rarity, but it's not the only example here in Williamsburg. As you walk around town, you'll see similar decorations on a few of the other houses. All right, let's leave the Coke Garrett House and continue down the street to the building right next door. This is the public jail. The public jail of Williamsburg was nothing like jails that exist today. This restored building represents one of the early public buildings in town. Remember that Williamsburg became the capital of Virginia in 1699, when the seat of government was moved from Jamestown. By April of 1700, the need for a jail was being discussed. By 1701, plans were in place, specifying the dimensions for a brick prison. Completed in 1703, the building itself looked pretty much like any other building in town. That's because it was built like a regular building, with the requisite dimensions being 20 feet wide by 30 feet long, the minimum building requirement at that time. The builder used the common brick pattern that I pointed out at the brick office of the Coke Garrett House. Do you remember that pattern? It's called Flemish Bond, and it's a pattern you're going to see a lot around town. Also, note another building feature that you may or may not notice on other brick buildings, the holes in certain parts of the walls. These are called putlog holes. That's spelled P-U-T-L-O-G. And they had a specific use. When a house was built, workers used scaffolding as they built each level. What supported that scaffolding? Wooden beams. And the ends of the beams created holes in the brick pattern. Usually the holes were filled in after the building was completed, but sometimes they weren't. That's why you might see holes in some of the walls around town. When the jail was complete, it had only 3 rooms on the first floor, the largest of which was used by the jailer himself as living quarters. The other 2 rooms were for the prisoners. There was also space in the upper level where petty offenders would be held. As I said, the building looks pretty much like any other residence in town except for one major subtle difference. Wooden barriers were placed underground to ensure that prisoners would not be able to dig their way out. But apparently, those wooden barriers didn't always stop prisoners from leaving. According to one story, at some point, the jail operated on the honor system. This was many years later, probably the early 1900s. One day, a prisoner who was serving a lengthy multi-year term decided that he needed to leave for a time. He left behind a note telling the jailer that he would be back shortly. As you can see, there is also a yard to the left or on the west side of the building that is surrounded by a tall brick wall. This allowed the prisoners some outside exercise and, as stated in the documents, for preservation of their life and health till trial. Till trial, that is an interesting point. In colonial times, people were held in the jail until trial. And even though Williamsburg did have a courthouse, the court was only in session at certain times, so prisoners here might have to remain in prison for a while. But at any rate, they were here because they were awaiting their trial, not being punished for their crime. There was one group that did spend quite a bit of time here, debtors, those who owed money to others. By 1712 or 1713, a new section was added especially for the debtors, and the new space was paid for from a tax on slaves and liquor. The debtors' situation was additionally unique in that somebody else had to pay for keeping them here. After all, they needed to eat, and although food was meager at best, somebody still had to pay for their sustenance. For the first 20 days, they were covered at public expense. After that, however, their creditors had to pay for their keep. That cost was about 6 pence per day, payable in cash or in tobacco, 5 pounds of tobacco. That can add up over time, can't it? Also, and this seems absurd, some prisoners could pay for their own food and drink, and they might order from the nearby taverns, a kind of colonial takeout. By the early 1770s, however, creditors were made totally responsible for the upkeep of their debtors at 3 times the regular fees. Speaking of prisoners, the jail in Williamsburg has been the home of some colorful characters, the most colorful of which might be Blackbeard's pirates. If you visited the surrounding area, you've probably heard the stories of the pirates that plied the waters just off the east coast of America. The most feared of those pirates was Edward Teach, known as Blackbeard. 15 of Blackbeard's pirates were captured in 1718 and held here before their trial, which probably took place in the capital, just across the street. All but two of those men were hanged on the gallows. By the way, those gallows existed on Capitol Landing Road, which becomes Waller Street here in town. In 1722, and then again in 1773, the jailer's living space was expanded, and it's a good thing. Another well-known person associated with the jail was the jailer who served just before and during the Revolutionary War. His name was Peter Pelham. Pelham lived here with his wife and family that included at least five children. We know that the Pelhams had 14 children, but many of them died when they were infants. We also know that at least one of the children was born at the jail. But being jailer was Peter Pelham's second job. His first job was as organist at Bruton Parish Church. He also taught young ladies the fine art of playing the piano. Even though Pelham was considered a fine musician, his salary as an organist was only £25, not nearly enough to support his family, so he added to his income by becoming the jailer, earning an additional £40 per year. Here's another little historic tidbit about Peter Pelham. 100 years later, Peter's descendant, John Pelham, would arrive in town during the Battle of Williamsburg in 1862. John Pelham was a young artillery officer with the Confederate Army, that's the Southern Army, who fought here during the Civil War in the Battle of Williamsburg. The public jail that you see today represents the building as it existed after the renovations of 1722 that included the prison cells, the exercise yard, and the jailer's quarters. During the Civil War, the building was just about demolished by the occupying Union troops. They needed the bricks. I guess they didn't really care about that nice, decorative brick pattern. In June 1935, restoration work began and the property was restored by April 1936. With that, we'll leave the public jail behind and move on to a property across the street and closely associated with the Capitol, the Secretary's office. From the jail, turn and face the Capitol, then cross the street and follow the pathway that goes uphill and turns to the right. It will lead you to the front door of the Secretary's office. As you walk up the pathway towards the Secretary's office, you'll notice a small graveyard surrounded by a brick wall. That is the burial place of the Jones family that lived here at the Secretary's office during the 1800s and 1900s. The Secretary's office is a unique building here in Williamsburg and, in fact, in America. This is the oldest existing building in America that was built as an archive to house and preserve paper documents. This is also the first building on this tour that you can clearly see architectural symmetry, where both sides of a building mirror each other, the same number of windows on each side of a central door, chimneys balancing both sides of the roof. There are many such examples of symmetry throughout the town. It was very important in the colonial era. The idea of the Secretary's office building came about because of a major fire. On January 30th, 1747, at about 8 o'clock in the morning, a fire broke out in the Capitol building, a fire so destructive that it would consume the entire structure, burning it to the ground. Not only did the Capitol house the governing body of the colony, it also housed the paperwork produced from that governing body. When the fire broke out, it burned through the ceiling and roof first, creating a grave danger to anyone who would venture inside. Even then, a few brave souls entered the building with the intent of saving the colony's precious documents, along with various portraits of the royal patrons. They succeeded. Once the documents had been rescued, the question immediately arose, what to do with them in order to protect and preserve these important papers. At first, the archive was removed to the nearby jail, to the jailer's quarters. But, just to give you an idea of the volume of paperwork, even during this early era of the colony, there is an account from the keeper of the jail stating that the room they took up in his house obliged him for some time to board out two of his children. So he moved the kids out so they could move the paperwork in. The children would remain out of the house for a year or so. In April 1747, the town council ordered the construction of a building specifically to house the records, and that building would become the secretary's office. It would be completed sometime around 1748. The building uses a typical design for a Virginia house, with two rooms and a hall. We don't know who designed and built the structure, but as you stand in front of it, you can easily see that beautiful symmetry and balance that I mentioned, as well as decorative elements such as the rounded roof shingles, the rubbed brick doorway, and the circular entry steps. Whoever made this was a master of design. As you can see, the walls are brick, in the pattern that I'm sure you recognize by now as Flemish bond. To further protect from fire, the original floors were made of stone. Since the purpose of the building was to protect the documents from destruction, the fact that there are four chimneys here and a wooden roof might seem a contradiction. However, creating a brick vault roof would have been very expensive. And those chimneys suggest a different use of the fireplace. If you're here in the warmer months, you may also notice that besides the heat, the humidity can be quite high in this region. We all know that over time, humidity can wreak havoc with paper. So one way that the dampness was controlled, at least to some degree, was to light small fires. So, in this case, fire could potentially destroy or save the papers. When the Capitol moved to Richmond, Virginia, in 1780, the archive moved as well. With that, the building underwent a series of uses and transformations. It remained as an office for a few years, but then in 1784, a grammar school was opened in the Capitol building, and the secretary's office became the home for the head of the school. By 1789, it was a rental property, and sometime after 1824, it became part of the female academy that occupied the site of the old Capitol. To give you an idea of how these buildings in town changed over time, at some point between the late 1800s and the early 1900s, the original building was whitewashed and wings were added. As I mentioned earlier, the Jones family lived here for many years. By the time the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation acquired the site in 1937, Mrs. Rowland Jones lived here, and the foundation granted her a life tenancy, which allowed Mrs. Jones to remain in the home rent-free until her death. The foundation would use life tenancies when it was necessary in order to acquire property that would be added to the restored town. Restoration of the property began in 1939, even while Mrs. Jones still lived there. However, when she died in 1964, work could begin in earnest. The foundation was free to complete the major restoration that included removal of all the extra additions and features that had been tacked onto the house over the years, returning this structure back to its original character. If you're ready, we're going to start our walk up Duke of Gloucester Street, so let's leave the secretary's office behind and move on to the small wooden building at the beginning of Duke of Gloucester Street. It's the first house on your right, with a porch in the front. Along with the taverns here in town, coffee houses were also important places where people gathered to drink and discuss the latest news. Next on our tour is one of those coffee houses, the one owned by Robert Charlton. I think you see that the Secretary's office was a very important building in Williamsburg, housing the archive of early documents for the Virginia colony. However, there were many places of equal, some might say greater, importance than the small brick office, and two of those important places were the tavern and the coffee house. Decidedly, both of these places were more mundane and commonplace, but they helped usher in the era of revolution. After all, the American Revolution started out as an exchange of ideas. And where do you think those ideas were exchanged? Why, here, in the coffee houses and taverns of Williamsburg, of course. In the 1760s, Richard Charlton and his wife Sally opened a coffee house here. Mr. Charlton chose his site well. Not only was the coffee house near the Capitol, it was also near an area known as the Exchange, which was a gathering place between the Secretary's office and the coffee house. If you were here in 1765, walking from the Secretary's office to Charlton's coffee house, you would have walked right through the Exchange. Like the early Wall Street in New York, the Exchange was a type of open-air financial market where merchants met to make deals and do business in the commodities of the day. Charlton fashioned his establishment after those he knew in England. Here's a little historic tidbit for you. There was a coffee house in London known as Lloyd's Coffee House. Shipping merchants and other such people met there regularly to discuss business, and eventually they started to invest in the various businesses. What with war brewing on a variety of fronts, moving and delivering merchandise from Europe to America meant great risk, not only to the cargo, but to the ships as well. Those men, meeting at Lloyd's Coffee House in London, decided to spread the risk of the business by making certain investments. As you might have guessed, these transactions eventually formed the group that we know today as Lloyd's of London, one of the largest insurers in the world. All that from a coffee house. As you approach the front of Charlton's, no doubt you noticed the sign out front. As you walk around town, you'll pass many such signs. Although we consider them quaint decorations today, in colonial times, these signs were not decorative. At a time when many were illiterate, pictures were used to denote a business, and often they could be unusual and humorous in their symbolism. Richard Charlton's Coffee House is just such a place. If you were to visit Charlton's in the 1760s, on any given day you would see businessmen, merchants, members of the government, and travelers discussing all manner of topics. You might also see people newly arrived in town picking up mail that might have arrived by one of the ocean-going merchant ships. You would not, however, see women here, as women were not allowed in this establishment. The Charltons had designed the coffee house with two different rooms. One for the lower social classes was your basic public room with no fancy trimmings or comforts. The other room was for the gentry, was more private, and sported niceties such as rugs on the floor. There was one space that was fair game for all patrons, the front porch. The porch that stretches across the front of Charltons appears unique. If you look around at other structures on Duke of Gloucester Street, you won't see porches like this. However, they were common by the Revolutionary War era. In fact, two other well-known establishments in town were known to have porches as well, the nearby Raleigh Tavern and Wetherburn's across the street. The porch could be considered an early experiment in social equality in America. Speaking of social equality, if you were here on October 30th, 1765, you would have seen the colony's very popular governor, Francis Fauquier, enjoying a coffee on the porch. And it's a good thing he was there. At the same time, in the street, an angry mob was threatening a man named George Mercer. Mercer was the British representative chosen to distribute the despised tax stamps. The Stamp Act was one of the early attempts by the British government to raise revenue from the colonies. It would become part of a long line of taxes and business restrictions that antagonized and angered the population. And on that October 30th, the townspeople had had enough. Seeing that the crowd not only threatened Mercer, but the governor himself, Fauquier intervened and escorted Mercer through the crowd, through the town, and back to his home, the governor's palace. The shaken George Mercer resigned his commission the next day. In 1767, Richard Charlton advertised that he was now offering lodging, meaning that he had expanded his business into a tavern. By the 1770s, however, the tavern had been moved to another site, and Christina Campbell may have taken over the building for a couple of years. In fact, you'll see the sign on the building next door, Edinburgh Castle, where Christina grew up, so she obviously knew the neighborhood well. By 1772, though, the building had become a shop. The building remained on this site until the late 1880s, at which time a large Victorian home was built here. When Colonial Williamsburg decided to reconstruct the coffee house, the home was not torn down. Instead, in the 1990s, not long ago, the house was preserved and moved to a location just outside of the historic area on Henry Street. With the lot now cleared, Williamsburg Foundation began the work to reconstruct the coffee house. This would be the first such reconstruction on Duke of Gloucester Street since the 1940s, and is an example of how continuing research and archaeology and funding impacts our understanding of the historic town. From Charlton's, let's continue down Duke of Gloucester Street. Coming up on your right, you'll see a white building with a sign out front. This is the Pastor and Galt Apothecary. An apothecary was a place that sold medicines, herbs, and other concoctions used as remedies for a wide assortment of ailments. One of the most striking and unusual features of this apothecary is the exterior of the building itself, especially the front. This is known as a rusticated facade. On first glance, you'd think the building was made of stone. However, this is an illusion. The facade is the same as many of the others in town, made of wood, but this wood was cut to resemble stone. If you visited Mount Vernon in Northern Virginia, this type of facing will look familiar, as it is the exact same type of exterior used for George Washington's home. Unlike some of the other reconstructions in town, the Pastor and Galt Apothecary stands on the same site where the original building stood. The property was purchased around 1760 by Dr. William Pasteur, and by 1775, on the eve of Revolution, he had joined in business with a competitor, Dr. John Minson Galt. They remained in business through the early years of the Revolutionary War until Dr. Pasteur retired. Both Pasteur and Galt were patriots, and they most certainly felt the effect of the war with the lack of supplies for the apothecary. Even so, the doctors continued in business and treated anyone who required medicines or their medical services. Pasteur served as mayor of the town in 1776. Galt served as a man midwife, delivering babies. Both men served the Continental Army, furnishing medicines, and with Galt serving as surgeon. Galt also served on the board of directors for the public hospital, and his grandson, John Minson Galt II, would go on to become the first superintendent of that institution. Let's continue down the street. The next site we're visiting is the Raleigh Tavern. Although only a tavern, this building has witnessed more history than just about every other building in this historic town, except maybe the Capitol. As you might have guessed, the Raleigh is named for Sir Walter Raleigh, who was one of the first to try to colonize Virginia in the late 1500s. I'm sure you'll notice the bust of Sir Walter Raleigh placed over the entry door. Meant to identify the building, the use of Raleigh's head is kind of ironic if you recall that he was beheaded in 1618. The Raleigh is associated with some of the earliest actions that led to the American Revolution. Two well-known social organizations were founded here, numerous celebratory dinners were held here, and two great leaders from World War II met here. The tavern was built sometime around 1717, and typical of such an establishment would cater to a wide variety of visitors and townsfolk, especially during the public times that occurred every 6 months when the courts were in session. By the 1760s, however, the Raleigh was becoming a gathering place for those men who would shape the foundations of our country. That decade saw growing arguments and outright protests against the increasing burdens placed on the colonies by Great Britain. The Virginia House of Burgesses, meeting at the Capitol, spoke loudly and clearly against the taxes and business restrictions that they saw as unfair controls over the growing country. Those arguments came to a head in May 1769 when the royal governor, Governor Botetou, took action. "Mr. Speaker and gentlemen of the House of Burgesses, I have heard of your resolves and augur ill of their effect. You have made it my duty to dissolve you, and you are dissolved accordingly." With that, the Burgesses vacated the Capitol and promptly moved over to the Raleigh Tavern. Meeting in the Apollo Room, they determined to give voice to the people of Virginia, no longer caring if they had permission from Great Britain or not. The scene would be repeated again in 1774 on the eve of Revolution. When the House of Burgesses protested the action against the recent Tea Party in Boston, the royal governor at that time, Governor Dunmore, dissolved the House. And of course, you know where they reconvened. You'd think that the royal governors would have learned that dissolving the House of Burgesses had the opposite effect of what they intended. Although revolutionary fervor grew and prospered here at the Raleigh, other less revolutionary activities took place here as well. For instance, in December 1776, a group of students from the nearby College of William and Mary met here in the Apollo Room, the very same room where the Burgesses met, and here they founded the Phi Beta Kappa Society. At least, that's the commonly accepted story. The fact that the students were here is a somewhat scandalous point. Apparently, students were not supposed to visit taverns. Instead, the College of William and Mary required that they drink on campus. The drink offered on campus, however, was much inferior to that offered by the taverns, so students would sneak out to the taverns, drink too much, and get into all sorts of trouble. A few years after Phi Beta Kappa was founded, another group met here to establish the Pulaski Society, honoring one of the Polish heroes of the Revolutionary War, Count Casimir Pulaski. That group still meets in town near the Tolliver Coal Shop. 1779, the same year that the Pulaski Society was founded, saw the first known public celebration of George Washington's birthday. The party held here became so raucous that the local soldiers had to be called to restore the peace. Speaking of Revolutionary War heroes, in 1824, a banquet was held to celebrate the return of one of the most honored heroes of the late war, the Marquis de Lafayette. It was said that the dinners and balls held at the Raleigh were as sumptuous as those held at the governor's palace. This being a tavern, as a public gathering place, there was one common yet notorious activity that occurred here. The regular auction of slaves took place on the tavern's front porch. One of the final notable events held here was in 1859. It was another banquet, this one arranged by the fair and accomplished ladies of Williamsburg for the alumni of William and Mary College, and that included President John Tyler. In December of that year, the Raleigh Tavern burns to the ground. The Raleigh Tavern is used as an exhibition building. In other words, it is not a functioning tavern such as Christina Campbell's. It's the first of that type of building to be restored in Colonial Williamsburg. Work began in 1929, and the dedication took place in 1932. At the dedication, the minister, who offered a final prayer, said, "God bless the Father, the Son, and the Williamsburg Holding Corporation." Oh, and those two great leaders from World War II who met here? Sir Winston Churchill and General Dwight D. Eisenhower had a drink together here in 1946. Be sure to visit the Raleigh Tavern Bakery and sample some of their cookies. And on hot summer days, you can get a cold drink and have a seat in the shade out back. With that, we'll move on to our next site, the James Craig Jewelers Shop, once known as the Golden Ball. As you walk around town, you may notice that some places are referred to as shops, while others are referred to as stores. Today, there is little difference between those words, but in colonial times, they meant different things. In the colonial era, a store was a place that sold general merchandise, hence the general store. The shop, however, was more specific. The shop was a place where a tradesperson would make and sell their goods to the public, and often an apprentice could be seen working alongside the master craftsman. As the town grew, you'd be likely to find trades such as tailor, wig maker, dressmaker, shoemaker, milliner, or woodworker among the variety of highly skilled craftsmen in Williamsburg, many of whom are represented in town today. The Golden Ball is the shop owned and run by a jeweler. In 1765, silversmith James Craig established his business here, and we see that by 1772, he is advertising his shop as the Golden Ball, a typical name for a jeweler's shop at that time. There is a story that Craig made a pair of earrings for Patsy Custis, Martha Washington's youngest daughter. Since we know that George Washington spent time here during the years before the Revolutionary War, perhaps he did a little shopping. You can just see him stepping out of the Capitol after a morning of heated arguments against Great Britain and going shopping. Patsy was Washington's beloved adopted daughter, and it's not at all a stretch to think that he would buy her something nice. Or maybe she asked for some jewelry. He certainly would not have denied the request. James Craig remained the proprietor of the Golden Ball throughout the Revolution, a time when such a business would have been difficult, to say the least. Typical of the shops in town, he and his family lived here until his death in 1790. One more note of interest. You might wonder where the raw material, the actual silver, was kept. Well, I can tell you that. The silversmith would have had some type of safe that was kept in the shop, and since an apprentice or other worker slept in the shop at night, there was always someone guarding the precious metal. The building that you see today is a reconstruction completed in 1948. This small shop has seen some historic and unique occurrences here in Williamsburg. First, the arrival in the 1960s of a young apprentice by the name of James Curtis. Curtis was the first African American to practice a trade here as someone other than a servant. As a tradesman, his role was twofold: to represent the craft as a person living in the colonial era, and to actually learn the craft. Curtis was outstanding in both of these roles. He rose through the ranks of apprenticeship to become a master tradesman in 1980. He was also a natural interpreter of the craft and enthusiastically engaged visitors in discussion and demonstration. Curtis also trained the first woman silversmith in town, Gail Clark. Curtis was here for almost 40 years until his retirement in 2000. but he left behind the next generation of craftsmen and craftswomen, ensuring the continuity of this important and beautiful trade in Williamsburg. Let's move on to another colonial-era shop. Adjoining the Golden Ball is the Margaret Hunter Millinery Shop. Now, I just mentioned the difference between a shop and a store. The Margaret Hunter Millinery Shop is a kind of hybrid, as are other shops in town. Mistress Hunter made goods for sale, but she also sold goods related to the items that she made. In Margaret Hunter's shop, townspeople would find all manner of clothing and accessories. If you needed a shirt or cloak in the cold weather, or if you wanted a new dress and a bonnet, those articles might be purchased here at Margaret Hunter's shop. You might also purchase imported cloth to have a suit or dress made. And how about accessories? They reflected popular fashion of the day and were known as ornaments or millinery. Not only did Hunter make everyday clothing for adults, children, and even babies, she also did embroidery and laundered delicate clothing. And even though she made clothing, she continued to import all manner of articles, the boxes on her shelves containing everything from jewelry to tea from London. During the years just before the Revolutionary War, Hunter's would be only one of five shops in town, and then, during the war itself, she was the only milliner still in operation. Hunter's shop is typical of the time. The building contained an unheated front room that served as the showroom for goods for sale. A back room, heated with a fireplace, was used as the counting office. Like the Golden Ball, this small building would be the shopkeeper's shop as well as their home. The building was constructed around 1740. Margaret Hunter took over sometime in the late 1760s as a renter, then as owner of the building in the early 1770s. Today, the Margaret Hunter shop is one of the few that contains much of its original brickwork. Just to give you an idea of how these buildings were changed over time, during the 1800s, a second story was added to the building, and then a flat brick facade was added, which contained advertising signs for a 1930s garage and gas station. All of that was removed when the building was restored during the first round of restorations in the 1930s. The raised steps that you see here are the result of a resident's memories of the early building. During Reconstruction of Williamsburg, many resources were used to recreate the original buildings, some of which included accounts of residents who recalled details and outstanding features that might not have been recorded or captured in early pictures. From here, we're going to walk down to one of the most important businesses in town. Let's move on to the collection of buildings that make up the printer, post office, and bookbinder. The post office and printer is another white building that is toward the end of the next block. After you cross Botetou Street, you should see a sign marking the post office and printing office. When you reach the corner at Botetou Street, before you cross the street, note the spacious home at the corner. This was the home of the Prentice family, who owned the business and the store that we'll see shortly. The original home was one of the earliest in town, built before 1725. The house burned to the ground in the 1840s and was reconstructed on the site in the 1930s. As we cross Botetou Street, let's talk a little bit about the layout of the town. When Duke of Gloucester Street was created, it was designed to be 99 feet wide and 1 mile long. The royal governor at the time, Francis Nicholson, desired an avenue that would offer a grand view of important buildings and places in town. The width of the street was enough to accommodate a grassy median at one time, and it could be very muddy in the rain. So muddy, in fact, that many said that the street was 99 feet wide and 2 feet deep in the mud. One major element that we take for granted was not part of the original town, the very place we're walking, the sidewalks. When the town was being resurrected, work was guided by the colonial revival ideal. Originally, buildings in town sat right at the street with no setback, which meant no room for a sidewalk. It was the colonial revival design that added the convenience of sidewalks. By now, you should be approaching the printer and post office. Throughout the mid-1700s, the man who ran the post office here in Williamsburg was William Hunter, a friend of Benjamin Franklin. By that time, the postal service in America had grown to include the major cities of the East Coast, from Boston through New York, Philadelphia, and through the South to Charleston, South Carolina. Here, residents could buy stamps and mail letters, and they could pick up mail as well. The post office also sold various writing supplies and sold the books, newspapers, and pamphlets produced in the printer's shop located downstairs. As colonial Williamsburg was being reconstructed, researchers often turned to archaeological evidence to find clues as to the type of activities that took place at a site over time. As you might expect, during archaeological excavations of the printer and post office, many different items related to printing were discovered. Those items included hundreds of pieces of type, that is, the actual letters used to create a printed page, along with the vessels that would have held the molten lead that produced those letters. So, not only did the printer use a variety of typefaces, he or she created them here as well. From other artifacts, we learned that the printed page was not the only type of printing that went on here. Lead markers that would have been used to print money were discovered on the site, along with tools used by a bookbinder. Those tools would have enhanced the crafts related to the printing business. So, from the archaeology of this location, we learn that the site must have been a hub of activity offering vital services and information in the years just before the Revolutionary War. To understand the importance of this place, we have to go back to the beginning of the colonies. During the 1600s and into the early 1700s, it was actually illegal to print things such as papers and documents. Only those holding a license from the king's representative or royal governor could print such things as newspapers, and during that time, no licenses were issued here. Hence, the printing of newspapers was prohibited. Today, it's hard to imagine a time when there was simply nothing printed in the colonies that would disseminate reliable, current information to the general public. That changed during the early 1700s as restrictions were eased. Then, in 1730, a man by the name of William Parks arrived from Annapolis, Maryland, to become the first public printer for Virginia, with the handsome annual sum of £120. The things he printed at first were among the most mundane of documents: manuals, reports, blank legal forms, and government documents such as proclamations. By 1736, however, Parks had established the first newspaper to be published in Virginia, called the Virginia Gazette. Some of the articles would be recognizable even today, such items as marriage and death notices. The only time, by the way, that a respectable woman could expect to have her name appear in the paper. Other reports are rather unique to the time. Notices seeking help for the recovery of missing farm animals, for example, or the more insidious report of runaway slaves and servants. There were notices of husbands who had abandoned their wives and families, and advertisements for the breeding and racing of thoroughbred horses. During the 1760s, the printing shop would change hands twice. The man who took over from Parks, a man by the name of William Hunter, is believed to have been the first person to publish papers written by George Washington. By 1766, Alexander Purdy had taken over. Early on, Purdy espoused a free and independent press, something that would become increasingly important as the colonies moved towards independence. 1766 was also the year that we see a second newspaper in operation, also called the Virginia Gazette. That paper would be run by a woman, Clementina Rind, after the death of her husband, who was the owner. She would be the first woman printer in town. It was Rind herself who set the type for one of the most famous political pamphlets of the day. Titled A Summary View of the Rights of British America, it was the work of Thomas Jefferson and led directly to his becoming the author of the Declaration of Independence. In the years leading up to the American Revolution, the printer came under increasing pressure to maintain good relations with both loyalists, those loyal to Great Britain, and those seeking independence from Great Britain. You'd think, in having to walk that fine line between both sides of the Revolution, there would be fewer newspapers in town. But by 1776, there were at least three newspapers in business, and they all were named the Virginia Gazette. The fact that three separate newspapers could thrive in this small town is a testament to the importance of their place in society and of their contribution that would fuel and stoke the fires of independence. There is much to see here, so make note to come back and spend some time with the Williamsburg printers. We're going to move on to one of the truly original buildings in town, the Prentice Store. The Prentice Store is the first building on your right after you cross Colonial Street. A few minutes ago, I pointed out the large, fine building that was the home of the Prentice family, who owned and operated the Prentice Store. The Prentice Store was one of the most prosperous businesses in Williamsburg, and as you approach the site, one of the first things you'll notice is the brickwork. Once again, another example of Flemish bond. Built in the late 1730s, the Prentice Store is not only the oldest surviving store in Williamsburg, it is the oldest surviving structure. The store shows us a true example of what buildings looked like in the colonial town, with their narrow sides facing the street. This way, more buildings could fit into this commercial strip, as we would call it today. For those few businesses that survived through the 19th century, we see some changes, often very dramatic changes, to the buildings themselves. But this building remained true to its original design, even though the front facade was modified to display advertising. In the early 1900s, the building was used as a gas station and auto supply store. Even though a substantial portion of the building itself remained original, some rebuilding and restoration was necessary to return the site back to its roots in the colonial era. According to store accounts, the building was valued at some £200, quite a large sum for the time. With dimensions measuring 24 feet wide by 36 feet deep, the size was considered fairly standard for a building. Also standard was the use of the interior space. You'll notice that the only windows towards the front of the building face the street. They were used to display goods. You can see this in other shops and stores around town as well, and many of those shops sported more decorative bay windows to display goods. When you stepped into the store, you would have seen quite a variety of items stacked on shelves that lined the walls. So no windows were necessary here. On the contrary, the back room, also called the counting room, required some light, often from windows, and some comfort, such as heat from a fireplace, for this is where the owner would have spent a good deal of time reconciling accounts and keeping the books of the business. You can be sure many times passers-by would see the light in the window as the store owner worked into the evening settling accounts. Another noticeable feature of this store is the second story opening just under the roof line. The second story of this type of building would have been used to store wares and provide living space for at least one clerk, probably more. When goods were delivered, they would have been hoisted from the street to the second floor using ropes. But it's interesting to note that an important feature appears to be missing here. That feature, a large wooden beam called a cat head, would have extended from the second floor opening. Ropes were usually slung over the beam, making it easier to lift the goods from the street. Now, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, this was one of the most successful businesses in town, so the delivery of goods and wares would have been frequent. Researchers have never found traces of this beam, so the question is, if that beam didn't exist here, how exactly did they lift the goods? The answer is, we're not really sure. There is an interesting story about a shipment of tea that was supposed to arrive here in 1774. Instead, that tea ended up in the York River as part of a tea party thrown by local patriots. Next up on our tour, we go back to the very beginning of Colonial Williamsburg. This is one of the oldest and most elegant homes in town, the Ludwell Paradise House. So if you're ready, let's walk to the house next door. The beautiful brick Ludwell Paradise House is a neighbor to the Prentice store, and you can recognize it by the double stairway at the front door. This house marks the origin of Colonial Williamsburg's restoration. This was the very first building purchased by Reverend William Goodwin for John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Purchased in 1926, it was the start of what would become the 88-building restoration of this colonial town. While we're walking to the Ludwell Paradise House, I'd like to talk a little bit about how John D. Rockefeller began the process of resurrecting and recreating Colonial Williamsburg. Utmost secrecy was necessary. If investors and speculators had gotten word of the plan, the project would not have succeeded. To hide his identity, he worked through Reverend William Archer Rutherford Goodwin, rector of Bruton Parish Church. When Dr. Goodwin heard that the Ludwell Paradise House was available, he notified Rockefeller that the house was being sold for a very low price of $8,000. With that news, Rockefeller authorized the purchase via telegram, stating, "Purchase of antique at 8." From the beginning, Rockefeller hid his identity to all but Dr. Goodwin, calling himself simply David's father. As Goodwin continued purchasing properties, the town residents became more and more suspicious about his suspicious activities with all of this buying of houses. People wanted to know how exactly he was able to make such purchases since Goodwin was not a wealthy man. So the townspeople went about trying to find out the identity of his investors. Even as he was fending off the curious, Goodwin was also concerned about those who still lived in the houses, many of whom were lifelong residents with family ties reaching back to the colonial era. He certainly did not want to force someone out of their home, and he stated to Rockefeller that, and I quote, "It would be difficult, if not impossible, and I am inclined to think inadvisable," end quote. They quickly came up with the idea of a life tenancy for those residents who would sell their properties. Using this plan, Goodwin purchased a variety of homes, often at very reasonable prices, a practice that got him into some trouble with the locals, who felt he was going way beyond his pastoral duties and taking advantage of people who had little. Still, the plan was beneficial to both the townspeople and to the overall plan of acquisitions to create the new old town. By now, you're probably wondering when residents finally got the full story. It was during a town meeting in 1928, but we'll get to that shortly. When they were finally told, one resident was heard to quip, Well, I lived through one reconstruction. I reckon I can live through another. All right, let's get back to the Ludwell Paradise House. The Ludwell family was the wealthiest family in this area, known as the Tidewater region. This house was built by Philip Ludwell III in the early 1750s. It was originally built as a rental property, a practice that was not uncommon as the town grew. And by now, you should easily recognize this as Flemish Bond brickwork, and a beautiful example it is. The house has also seen some very colorful characters. After the Revolutionary War, Philip's daughter, Lucy Ludwell Paradise, lived here. Although she lived a life at the highest levels of society, Lucy was a very odd person, an eccentric, who was despised by many in the town's close-knit social circles. Others, though, overlooking her peculiarities, considered her a fascinating, worldly figure of elegance and graciousness. Lucy and her husband John had a daughter that they named Lucy. The daughter married a Venetian count by the name of Antonio Barziza, and their son, Viscount Philip Barziza, came to Williamsburg and married one of the town's prominent young ladies. Viscount Barziza and his wife would have 10 children, and they named the 10th child Decimus et Ultimus, 10th and final. Decimus et Ultimus Barziza would fight with the 4th Texas Infantry in the Civil War and would be wounded and captured at Gettysburg. By the time the house was restored in 1931, it had been altered many times. So much so that the restoration involved the removal of things like a front porch that extended almost the whole length of the building, the front steps, a cellar door, and shutters on the windows. As the first of the restored buildings, this must have been a daunting task. Rather than starting with a small, rather simple restoration, they took on one of the best-known buildings in town. But that restoration set the tone for all of the other buildings that would make up the historic core of Williamsburg. Let's leave high society behind for now and move on to one of the working class establishments, another of the well-known taverns in town, Josiah Chuning's Tavern. You'll see the tavern right after you cross Queen Street. It's the first building in the next block, just before the courthouse. I hereby acquaint the public that I have opened a tavern at the house where I formerly lived, where all who please to favor me with their custom may depend upon the best of entertainment for themselves, servants, and horses, and good pasturage. With that advertisement in the local paper, Josiah Chuning opened his tavern here in 1766. By the way, I'm using the pronunciation that was in vogue a few years ago. Today, most people pronounce the name as Chowning, so you may hear either pronunciation. Little is known about Josiah Chuning, but it appears that he operated his tavern here for only 2 years. By 1768, another operator was advertising his tavern business at this location. Unlike many of the other businesses in town that remained here for many years, this property saw quite a bit of turnover. For instance, prior to its use as a tavern, the property was owned by a tailor and then a blacksmith. When Chuning opened his tavern, he served the middling sort, those residents and visitors who might be merchants, shopkeepers, farmers. In other words, those who were considered part of the middle or even lower classes. And those are the very people one would find in this area on Market Square, on market days when buyers and sellers would crowd the town. And since those visitors would be looking for something to eat and drink, Chuning's sign would let them know that they would be most welcome and that they would receive a good meal here. In addition, they would have entertainment in the form of singing and gaming, a tradition that continues today. The market square of colonial times could be compared to our farmers' markets of today, with one major exception. Along with all of the food and goods sold, auctions took place here on a regular basis. Owners might auction land, but they might also auction slaves. In fact, after Josiah Tuning's death in 1772, some of his property, including a slave, was auctioned off right across the lawn near the courthouse. Since there is not much known about the property, architects decided to reconstruct Tuning's as an authentic working-class tavern, serving, as they said, the middle-class Virginian. Today, you'll find the same type of hearty fare that was served by Josiah Tuning, and you'll also be able to play the same type of games and sing the same songs that patrons of the colonial town would have enjoyed on any given evening. With Tuning's, it's time to leave tavern life behind. Next, we'll make the short walk over to another of the important public buildings in Williamsburg, the courthouse. The courthouse is the official-looking brick building next to Tuning's, sitting in the center of what was Market Square and the parade ground. A few minutes ago, I mentioned that Rockefeller's identity was revealed in 1928. On June 12, 1928, a momentous meeting was held at the high school. Today, this is the location of the Governor's Palace. The purpose of the meeting was to discuss and vote on the transfer of certain public properties, including the Market Square, where we are right now, and the Palace Green, to Dr. William Goodwin, who, as you know, had been acting as John D. Rockefeller's representative. Up to the time of that meeting, Rockefeller's relationship to the purchases was a heavily guarded secret, but people knew that Goodwin certainly didn't have the finances to make the purchases on his own, and with each new purchase, their curiosity grew. Almost all of the town's 150 or so residents had turned out for the meeting. Remember that this is still a small town, so 150 is a pretty big number. To say the atmosphere in the room was intense would be an understatement. The time had finally come to reveal the secret. After the purchases were discussed, and the townsfolk assured that they would continue to have access to the public areas, Goodwin rose to make his announcement, saying, "It is now my very great privilege and pleasure to announce that the donors of the money to restore Williamsburg are Mr. and Mrs. John D. Rockefeller, Jr. of New York." Well, as you can imagine, pandemonium ensued. But eventually the meeting would be brought to order again and the vote taken. With just a few dissenters, the entire assembly voted in favor of the property transfer. With that, the town would receive a new courthouse, a new jail, and a firehouse, along with planned utilities, sewer and water, and improved streets and sidewalks, things we'd call infrastructure today. Just think, that vote taken in 1928 literally laid the groundwork for the reconstruction. If that vote had failed, the town you're visiting today would probably look very different, or it may not exist at all. The courthouse you see today reflects the original building that was erected in 1770. Note the weather vane at the top of the cupola. That is the original weather vane from 1770. At the time it was built, architects understand that the builders intended to import columns from England and add them to support the pediment, the piece that looks like an overhang. The stone of the columns would have matched the stone steps that exist today. However, think about what was happening in the early 1770s. Animosity between the colonies and England was growing rapidly, leading to the call for independence and the Revolutionary War. As I've mentioned, goods and supplies, including building supplies, would become quite scarce, and this impacted the front of the courthouse. The columns would never arrive, and the front would remain unfinished until the early 1900s. After a fire in 1911, the town decided to include the columns as part of the repairs. They wouldn't be there for very long. The courthouse, using the original design of 1770 without the columns, was restored in 1932. Both the Hustings Court, that's the local court for Williamsburg, and the James City County Court met here each month, bringing residents from the jail, lawyers, and accusers together to sort out their differences. Court sessions would last until all cases were heard. That could last a few days. Townspeople would crowd into the court to watch the proceedings. Put yourself into that crowd and imagine the cases that would come before the court. You might see debtors and their creditors. You might see petty thieves accused of stealing goods or somebody's chickens or pigs. Not only would you hear the proceedings, many times you'd get to see the sentence carried out, for right outside the front door, near the steps, you'd find the whipping post used for public floggings. Or, for the petty offenders, you might see them locked into the stocks to be ridiculed by passers-by. I mentioned the stone steps at the entry. During market days, you might see auctions take place here. In particular, you might see the auction of slaves. It was here that Josiah Tuning's slave was auctioned. But this was also the site of great celebration. If you were here on July 25th, 1776, you would have witnessed the first reading of the Declaration of Independence. In the colonial era, the local militia trained in the fields near the courthouse, which certainly would have drawn the interest of the townspeople. The militia was made up of members of all social classes, one of the only times that the wealthy would work side by side with the middling class. Also, it was here in the courthouse that voters would choose their representatives for the House of Burgesses. During the Civil War, the building saw activity as a Confederate hospital. Afterwards, it would continue as an active courthouse until 1931, when, after that fateful meeting that revealed John D. Rockefeller as the engine behind the Restoration, Colonial Williamsburg took over not just the courthouse, but the adjoining green area as well. And the rest, as they say, is history. We're now going to move away from Duke of Gloucester Street and the commercial side of town for a few minutes, so that we can visit the residential section, where we'll see some of Williamsburg's finest private homes. The first home we'll visit is the dark red house on the opposite side of the grounds behind the courthouse. Let's walk to the back of the courthouse, then cross the green to the corner of Nicholson and North England Street. This is the Peyton Randolph home, or, as Thomas Jefferson and probably every other colonial citizen pronounced it, the Peyton Randolph home. For this tour, I'll use the modern pronunciation, but you can feel free to pronounce it either way. The open ground that we're walking has served various functions over time. It is the parade ground where you can still see the modern-day militia as they go through their exercises. Today, we call them the Williamsburg Fife and Drum Corps. The area is also part of Market Square, where goods were sold and fairs were held. And of course, being the green next to the courthouse, you would have seen everyone walking through this area as they arrived for the proceedings. Speaking of people arriving for the proceedings, be aware that we are walking in the footsteps of the patriots who led America to independence. Leading men of the colonies, Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, George Washington, might have strolled this lawn as they discussed the actions that would lead to independence and a war with Britain. By now, you should be quite near the Peyton Randolph House at the corner of North England and Nicholson Streets. This is the home of one of the Virginia colony's most influential families. The size of the Peyton Randolph home tells us that this is the residence of someone of high standing in the community. And indeed it was. Beginning in 1724, and for the next 60 years, the house was occupied by the Randolph family. In 1724, John Randolph purchased the existing two-story structure. At that time, apparently, it was one of the first two-story or double-pile buildings, as they were also called, not only here in Williamsburg, but in the colony of Virginia. The only other such double-pile building was the governor's palace. Also, at the time John Randolph purchased the property, the building faced North England Street, not the town square as it does today. After John Randolph purchased this property in 1724, he and his wife, Susanna, moved in, bringing along four children, including Peyton and his brother John. In 1733, a momentous occasion occurred. John Randolph was knighted by the king. At that time, it was King George II, the only such honor bestowed on a Virginian at the time. The following year, Sir John Randolph becomes Speaker of the House of Burgesses, but he didn't live much longer. Sir John died in 1737. He was only 43 or 44 years old. Even in death, he was honored. He was buried in the crypt of the College of William and Mary, his alma mater. Peyton Randolph inherited the property after his father's death. However, John had provided for his wife, Susanna, with life rights to the property, a very early use of what we would call a life estate today. Peyton married into an equally distinguished colonial family, the Harrisons. In 1746, he married Elizabeth Harrison. They called her Betty. Betty's brother Benjamin was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and her nephew, William Henry Harrison, would become President of the United States. Peyton followed in his father's footsteps, studying law at the College of William and Mary and gaining high-ranking positions in the colony. In 1744, he is appointed Attorney General for the colony, and 20 years later, he becomes Speaker for the House of Burgesses. While the Randolphs lived here, especially when Peyton took over the property, changes were made that expanded the building and moved the position of the house. During the 1750s, additions to the house just about doubled its size, and it was during that time that the house was turned 90 degrees to face Market Square. A ballroom was added. This was the time for ballrooms, as we see them being added to taverns and the governor's palace as well. The additions to the Randolph home created an interesting external feature that you can see if you look at the roof line. On the west or left side of the building, the roof is hipped. On the right side, it is gabled. Elements of the building actually mimic the brick buildings around town. The dark red paint color imitates dark red brick, and that wooden strip at the second floor level resembles the brick belt courses that you'll notice on many of the brick buildings in town. The interior of the house contains a number of rooms that are paneled, a rarity for any home at that time. And one of those rooms is paneled in oak, a very impressive detail and a statement of the prosperity of the Randolphs. Now, with a house and property of this size, you can imagine that it required a large number of servants, and that included enslaved workers as well. In fact, Peyton Randolph was one of the largest slave owners in Williamsburg, with almost 30 slaves working here by 1775. The number decreased during the war, however, as several slaves left the household. In the years immediately before the Revolution, Peyton Randolph served as the president of both of the Continental Congresses. In that position, he is sometimes hailed as America's first president. But of course, we don't have a country quite yet, so that is a dubious point. However, when he returned from the First Continental Congress, the militia declared him the father of our country. So perhaps instead of calling him the first president in America, we might think of him as the precursor to George Washington as the father of our country. Peyton Randolph is rarely mentioned with the founding fathers, and that's partly because he died suddenly in 1775, shortly after he arrived in Philadelphia and right before the colonies declared independence. Even so, he is certainly part of that rare group of men who had the education, the intellect, and the courage to create our country. You hear stories about how families were divided in their loyalties to America or Great Britain. The Randolph family was no exception. Peyton's brother, John, would take his family and move back to England when war broke out. They left behind their son, Edmund, who remained loyal to America. As I mentioned, Peyton's wife, Betty, would remain in the home throughout the war. Toward the end of the war, the Count de Rochambeau lived here, right before the surrender at Yorktown. Shortly after the surrender, Betty died, and since the Randolphs had no children, the house and contents were sold at auction. In 1824, one of the last distinguished visitors from the war would use the home. The Marquis de Lafayette stayed here during his grand tour of America. The house was acquired by Colonial Williamsburg in 1938, and although the main portion of the house was found to be in good shape, the remaining structures needed to be reconstructed. As with other properties in town, archaeology played an important role in determining the existence and placement of many of the buildings on this extensive property. From the Randolph home, we're going to retrace our steps across the Market Square Green toward the courthouse. Then we'll turn right and continue our walk up Duke of Gloucester Street. You'll see that this side of town, which is much farther away from the Capitol, has fewer businesses but larger homes. Next on our tour is one of the small stores in town, the Mary Dickinson store. As we leave Nicholson Street and walk back to Duke of Gloucester Street, let's talk a little bit about how these streets were named. With a name like Duke of Gloucester, obviously this street was named for somebody important. That somebody was the young Prince William, the Duke of Gloucester, who died when he was just 11 years old. The town of Williamsburg itself is named for William's godfather, King William III. The man who named the street was Royal Governor Francis Nicholson, who played a major role in moving the capital from Jamestown to Williamsburg, and who planned much of the early town. Besides being governor of Virginia, at various times Nicholson also served as governor of Maryland, South Carolina, and Nova Scotia, and he also founded Annapolis, Maryland. Oh, and he also named two of the town's major streets after himself. We just left Nicholson Street, which is the major parallel street north of Duke of Gloucester. So what do you think the major parallel street south of Duke of Gloucester is? If you guessed Francis Street, you would be correct. As we approach Duke of Gloucester Street, you can't help but notice the large brick building on your right that faces the green at Market Square. This building, although original, is not part of Colonial Williamsburg's historic interpretation, and it is privately owned. This is the Roscoe Coal House, named for a merchant who operated a store, possibly a dry goods store, in the adjoining building. The building is early 19th century architecture, which contrasts with the surrounding colonial era buildings. I mention it only because of its prominent location, and many visitors are curious about the structure. By now, you should be back at the courthouse and Duke of Gloucester Street, so turn right onto Duke of Gloucester. In the small group of buildings coming up on your right, you'll see the Mary Dickinson store. Remember the difference between a shop and a store? Shops were places where tradesmen sold the goods that they made. Stores were more general in nature, selling a variety of goods from a variety of sources. With the Mary Dickinson store, we come to another business run by a woman. When you think of the colonial era, especially here in the South, you don't usually think of women as being business owners or working for a living. But here in Colonial Williamsburg, we see a number of such women. Of course, one of the best known is Christina Campbell. We've seen Margaret Hunter's shop up near the Capitol, and we talked about Clementina Rind, the printer who owned a local newspaper. Similar to Margaret Hunter, Mary Dickinson offered a variety of goods that included millinery and jewelry. And rather than just advertising her store, Mary also included the store's location, pointing out that it was near the church, perhaps to ensure that customers would not head toward the other side of town near the Capitol. True to its origins, the shop still offers the types of items that would have been sold here in the years just prior to the Revolutionary War. The buildings next door to Mary Dickinson's store are part of a complex that included a family home, foundry, and silversmith. These are the buildings that were owned by the James Getty family. The Getty home sits on the corner of Duke of Gloucester Street and Palace Green. The shop is to the right of the house, and the foundry is behind the house. In 1738, the gunsmith, James Getty, acquired the site, and it was during that time that he established his family and his business here. James Getty died in 1744, at which time the property passed to his widow, Anne. But it was after Anne sold the property to their son, James Getty, Jr., that the property took on the character that we see today. James, Jr. was a silversmith who had apprenticed here in town. After he took ownership in the 1760s, Getty proceeded to build the house that sits on the corner, along with the silversmith's shop just to the right of the family home. The house is original to the lot, and very little reconstruction or restoration was necessary. From where you stand, you cannot see the actual shape of the house, but it is an L shape, a rare and unusual design for Williamsburg, which may have allowed Getty to take advantage of its location on the Palace Green. Other features of the house design are unusual. The pitch of the roof is lower than what you normally see, and note that it does not include dormers, those windows that protrude from the roof. And note the front porch and the balcony with a doorway, unusual for houses in Williamsburg. If you look at old photographs of this house, you'll see that it has hardly been modified since the time it was first constructed in the early 1760s. Not only was James Getty, Jr. a silversmith, he repaired silver pieces and jewelry, including watches, and he also worked as a goldsmith. He was considered one of the best silversmiths in the area. And James didn't work here alone. His brothers, William and David, who had taken over the gunsmithing and foundry operations from their father, continued to run that portion of the business. In fact, William ran a successful operation here for about 30 years, and the foundry operated for almost 50 years. A number of workers contributed to the output of the foundry, including apprentices and journeymen. In the years before the war, the foundry made all sorts of articles, including fine buckles for both men's and women's shoes. The business also produced finished metal for home interiors, and it also produced silverware. And do you know that there were actually two types of metal production? Depending on the item being made, the metal was either pounded into the form, or it was melted and poured into a mold. Both techniques were used here. The Gettys also advertised their service in gunwork, producing and repairing firearms, as well as casting ammunition, services that would be in great demand during the American Revolution. An engraver, William Waddill, joined the group and the family when he married James' sister and brought yet another desirable skill to the shop. Apparently, Waddill was an excellent engraver, and we have evidence of that because the Getty shop was asked to create the silver nameplate, handles, and a number of decorative plates called escutcheons for Royal Governor Lord Botetourt's coffin. The business prospered in the years before the revolution, but even so, Getty still had to advertise to attract business. In 1771, we see an advertisement in the local paper stating that he hoped his affordable prices would, and I quote, "remove the objection of his shops being too high uptown, and the walk may be thought rather an amusement than a fatigue," end quote. Similar to Benjamin Powell, who we met at the beginning of this tour, James Getty Jr. rose to prominence in town and was made a member of the town's governing body, the town council. He was one of only three craftsmen to gain such a position. As the colony moved to independence, James sided with the Patriots, even though it would cost him his business. In fact, with the shortage of supplies, especially the gold and silver he needed for his craft, James was forced to close the business, and in 1777 he puts the house up for sale, and he, his wife, and their five children leave Williamsburg. They do not return. However, by the early 1900s, another Getty will own and live in the house. Vernon Getty Sr., an attorney here in Williamsburg, worked alongside Reverend Goodwin and John D. Rockefeller, preparing the titles and the deeds of the properties that would make up Colonial Williamsburg. As I've mentioned, the Getty home has been altered very little since it was built back in the 1760s. Some restoration was done after the property was acquired in the 1930s, and additional work was done in the 1960s. The other buildings, including the foundry, had to be rebuilt to complete the historic reconstruction. If you're ready to move on, let's continue past the Getty Foundry and walk a few steps down Palace Green to the Thomas Everard House. The Everard House is close to the Governor's Palace, so if you walk up Palace Green toward the palace, you'll see Everard's home on your right. Thomas Everard, who served as mayor of Williamsburg in the years just before the Revolution, owned the property in the 1770s. Archaeological research has shown that this is one of the earliest structures in Williamsburg. Note the chimneys. If you look at other homes in town, you'll see that the chimneys are usually located at each end of the house, but in this case, they are located on the back part of the roof. This placement may mean that there was once a plan to enlarge the home. Of the various outbuildings that existed on this site, the brick kitchen has survived, making it only one of two 18th century kitchens that still exist here in Williamsburg. At some point, woodwork was added to the interior, an interesting feature that added considerably to the value of the home. Who added the woodwork, researchers can only speculate. But for such a small dwelling, items like mantels, paneling in the stairway, and door frames are much richer than you would normally find, and those additions have been compared to some of the grander homes in the area. The house is sometimes open for tours, so make note to come back and see the interior of this interesting building. Thomas Everard came to Virginia the same way many young men came to Virginia, as an apprentice. But Everard was also an orphan. Fortunately, though, he had been trained as a bookkeeper and had learned record organization, skills that would serve him well when he arrived here. Working in the secretary's office, Everard completed his apprenticeship within 7 years, and by the early 1740s, he was serving as a clerk in nearby Elizabeth City. From there, he served many years as the clerk of York County, and would also go back to the secretary's office, this time as the clerk. As I mentioned, Everard served as mayor of Williamsburg, and he joined the directors of the public hospital. Everard prospered here, marrying Diana Robinson, a young socialite, in the 1740s. They had two daughters, Frances and Martha. Per custom at that time, the girls were known by their nicknames, Fanny and Patsy. Diana died around 10 years later, leaving Thomas to raise their two daughters. By the 1770s, as a rising, prominent member of the city, Everard served on the committee that elected Virginia's delegates to the Continental Congress. His property by then consisted of over 1,500 acres of land in Virginia and a large number of slaves. One of those slaves was Everard's manservant, Bristol. Bristol's responsibilities included laying out his master's clothing each day, supervising the other slaves who served meals, and accompanying Everard when he went out. Bristol had been taught to read, providing a skill that allowed him to run errands, which allowed him a measure of freedom, and a chance to socialize with some of the slaves in the nearby governor's palace. Everard died in 1781. Up until that time, he was still serving as the clerk of York County Court. The house was restored beginning in the late 1940s, offering visitors a unique look into the life of a man who began life as an orphan and raised himself to prominence and respected status in the 25 years that he lived and worked here. Speaking of prominent men, we're now going to cross Palace Green and visit the home of another of the most prominent men in the colony of Virginia, George Wythe. From the Everard home, simply cross the green, then turn left and walk to the large brick home at the corner of Prince George Street and Palace Green. The George Wythe House has quite a distinguished pedigree. It was not, however, built by George Wythe. It was built by Wythe's father-in-law, Richard Tolliver, in the early 1750s. Tolliver was another of the wealthy Virginia planters of the colonial era, but he was more than that. He was also an undertaker. Remember that the term undertaker at that time meant someone who built things. And indeed, it is possible that Tolliver actually designed this house. At the time his house was being built, Tolliver was working on repairs and additions to the governor's palace, so it makes sense that he would want the convenience of having his own home nearby. On the eve of the Revolutionary War, Thomas Jefferson brought his family to the Wythe House while he served as a member of the General Assembly. At the end of the Revolutionary War, the house served as headquarters for George Washington. Then, shortly after the surrender at Yorktown, General Rochambeau stayed here while his troops encamped around town. Although George Wythe stands with the Founding Fathers, having served as mayor of Williamsburg, as a member of the House of Burgesses, and then as a member of the Continental Congress, he is best known in his role as a teacher to the likes of Thomas Jefferson, St. George Tucker, John Marshall, and Henry Clay. Wythe himself had little formal education, having been schooled early on by his mother, who was a well-educated Quaker. She taught him Greek and Latin, and imparted her love of the classics and a classical education to her son. Wythe is considered one of America's greatest legal scholars and teachers. Even though we call this house the George Wythe House, the Wythes did not own the home. It is believed that sometime after he married Richard Tolliver's daughter Elizabeth, the couple would receive what we would call today a life estate, allowing Elizabeth and George Wythe to remain on the property for life. They would occupy the property for the next 40 years, and like the Randolphs, the Wythes had no children, and like the Randolphs, they owned a number of slaves. Like many of his fellow patriots, and possibly because of his mother's Quaker influence, Wythe personally opposed the institution of slavery, and in fact, he would educate and would free some of his slaves. Elizabeth Wythe died in 1787, and a few years later, George moved to Richmond, which had recently become the new capital city. When he moved, he brought two of his freed slaves with him, one of whom was Lydia Broadnax. It was there in Richmond in 1806 that he met his demise under suspicious circumstances. Wythe's renown as teacher and patriot did not protect him from a nefarious grandnephew who lived with him. Historians believe Wythe was poisoned by this grandnephew, George Wythe Sweeney, who had laced Wythe's coffee with arsenic. Sweeney believed that he would inherit the Wythe estate, and he might have been convicted of the crime if circumstances had been different. Apparently, the eyewitness to the crime was Wythe's housekeeper, Lydia Broadnax. But Broadnax, being a free black woman, was barred by law from testifying against the white George Wythe Sweeney. So it may very well be that Sweeney literally got away with murder, but George Wythe still prevailed even in death. Sweeney did not know that the elder Wythe had disinherited him. In the early 1920s, it was here that the wheels would begin turning for the grand plan that would create Colonial Williamsburg. With the restoration of the historic town just a flicker of an idea, Reverend William Goodwin purchased the home for Bruton Parish Church, and he would establish his offices here. It was here, at Wythe House, that Goodwin would first meet with architect William G. Perry, who would become the architect for this unparalleled restoration. In 1927, when the Rockefellers visited, Goodwin brought them here after a walk around the town. As the story goes, when Goodwin escorted the Rockefellers back to Wythe House, he pointed out that the very room they were sitting in, the study, was the same place where George Wythe instructed Thomas Jefferson in law. It was during this meeting that Rockefeller stated that he didn't want to just restore a building here and a building there. He had decided that the entire town would be the restoration. Also, it was at this meeting that William G. Perry was assigned the architectural duties. He was to create the plan for the town, and Goodwin would begin purchasing single properties as they became available. It was like a great puzzle. Perry would create the puzzle, and Goodwin would start filling in the pieces. This house was, and is today, considered the finest, the most distinguished house in Williamsburg. In the Wythe House, we see a fine example of the architectural symmetry that was so desirable at the time. The balance between the elements on the right and left sides of the house, along with the fine brickwork and decorative architectural elements, make this a very pleasing house to view. Note the two large chimneys. They are positioned to provide fireplaces in each room. If you take a walk in the garden, you'll see the same type of symmetry in the way the plantings are laid out. In 1938, the property was transferred to Colonial Williamsburg, and it was restored by 1940, once again returning the house to its original appearance when it was occupied by one of the foremost leaders of early America. We're going to leave this historic home now and visit another of the grand homes in town, the second-to-last stop on our tour, the Robert Carter House. To get there, simply walk up Palace Green towards the palace. The Carter home will be the last house on the left, just before the governor's palace. The Robert Carter House has been here since it was built in the early 1700s. Note that this home is a private residence, so please keep this in mind when viewing the property. Although Carter was born into one of the most notable of Virginia families, his grandfather was Robert King Carter, one of the wealthiest landowners in the colony. And although he studied law in London, Robert doesn't seem to have embraced the life of an elite member of society. And for this, he was disdained by some, failing to gain a seat in the House of Burgesses. Still, he and his wife, Frances, were members of high society here in Williamsburg and entertained often and lavishly. George Washington even noted that he had dined at the Carter home. Even with that social standing, Carter seems to have followed his own course in life, concentrating on growing tobacco at his plantation and gaining a seat on the Royal Governor's Council, a seat he held until the start of the Revolutionary War. In 1761, Robert Carter purchased this property and would own it for almost 40 years. A few years before he purchased it, this was the temporary residence of the royal governor, Robert Dinwiddie, who used the premises while the palace was undergoing repair, so this was no humble abode. As you approach the house, you can view one of the most notable features of the building, the roof. This type of roof, known as a mansard roof, was a rarity in this area, not only for Williamsburg, but for Virginia itself. Also, most of the weatherboard exterior is original to the house, as are many of the shutters and window frames. The property encompasses a number of features. Besides the house itself, there is an adjoining wing on the right and a covered walkway on the left that connects to a small house that was once owned by a doctor. Carter also owned a plantation called Nominee Hall in nearby Westmoreland County, but he and Francis, along with their family, lived here in Williamsburg for about 12 years. And what a family! While they lived here, Robert and his wife had 9 children, but that was 9 of a total 17. 17 children, 4 boys and 13 girls, and of that large number, 12 actually reached adulthood. Even with such a large family, Carter still found time to enjoy musical endeavors. According to the tutor who instructed the Carter children, Carter himself enjoyed playing music, and the tutor stated that Carter played a number of instruments, including the harpsichord and piano, the guitar, violin, and flute. You won't be surprised to hear that the Carters felt their home here in town was too small, and when 3 of his daughters died, one right after the other, Carter decided to move his family back to Nominee Hall. Like many of his English contemporaries, Carter was a member of the Anglican Church. However, very shortly after the war, he was baptized in the Baptist Church. But by the 1780s, he had switched his religious allegiance to the beliefs of Emanuel Swedenborg. Like I said, Carter appears to have followed his own way. His singular lifestyle reached as far as the hundreds of slaves that he had inherited. Opposed to the institution of slavery, by 1791, Carter moved to emancipate those slaves, surely one of the largest groups emancipated prior to the 1860s. They weren't all emancipated at once, however, Virginia not being a very friendly state for such an action. Instead, it would take over 10 years before all of his slaves were freed, and by then, Carter was dead. He died unexpectedly in Baltimore in 1804, and is buried at the family plantation at Nominee Hall. During the Battle of Williamsburg in 1862, the house was completely ransacked by the Union Army. By then, Robert Saunders Jr. was the owner, the Saunders family having purchased the property in 1801. Apparently, nothing was left untouched, and even the structure itself was damaged. Someone noted that hundreds of heavy-booted and spurred cavalrymen had played football with everything of value in the house. Besides the abuse of the home during the Civil War, other drastic changes were made to the house over time. For instance, in the 1800s, the front of the house sported a huge 2-story porch with large Doric columns on both levels that obliterated the entire center of the facade. This overbearing structure was removed during the restoration of 1951, replacing it with the much smaller porch you see today. As I mentioned, the house and its outbuildings are largely original, but the Carter office on the right and the covered walkway had to be reconstructed. That reconstruction took place from 1931 to 1932, and additional work was completed from 1951 through 1953. We're going to leave the Carter House now and walk over to the most significant and magnificent building in town, the Governor's Palace. To get the full, impressive view of this building, I suggest you walk into the park in front of the palace. On this tour, we've seen the most elegant homes in Williamsburg, the homes of some of the most powerful men of colonial Virginia, in fact, in colonial America. With the governor's palace, we come to the final stop on our tour and to the largest, most extravagant, and imposing dwelling in town. Whether you were a visitor or a resident, the governor's palace was built to impress. No matter what side you approach from, it is clear that symmetry plays an important role here, especially in the design of the building and in the layout of the grounds and plantings. The overall design made a statement. Here was the home of someone of great wealth, power, and social standing. But this was also the home of someone with refined taste, where you could expect a gracious welcome. So, are you impressed? Edward Knott was the royal governor in 1705, and it was Knott who presented the House of Burgesses with the idea, as he put it, of building a house fit for the reception of your governor. Although the Burgesses agreed that such a house was needed, what they couldn't agree on was how they should pay for such a place. It was decided early the following year that imports of slaves and liquor should be taxed. It wasn't the first time that a duty on the import of slaves or liquor was used to raise funds in the colony. The amount was some £3,000. From the beginning, though, there was enough drama to inspire any of the well-known playwrights of the day. First, Governor Knott died within a year after building was begun. The next royal governor was captured at sea. It would be another 4 years before the next governor would finally arrive. By the time Alexander Spotswood arrived in 1710, the house itself was nearing completion, but it would still take a number of years and a few thousand more pounds to get the job done. And during that time, Governor Spotswood, who would prove to be a very capable manager, was taking over the responsibility for the building. And even though Spotswood paid for many elements of the building himself, his enemies still charged him with extravagances and unnecessary expenditures. In fact, in December 1714, some of those opponents were referring to the building with disdain as the palace, the first time we would hear that reference. The palace was complete by 1720, and as I mentioned previously, in the early 1750s, ballroom additions were all the rage in the large taverns and residences in town. So the palace got its ballroom and a dining room in 1754. The person who oversaw that construction was Richard Tolliver, the same man who built himself a house nearby, the George Wythe House. To give you an example of how difficult it was to build a structure of this size in the 1700s, here is the story of the builder, Henry Carey. By 1709, Carey had been struggling to put a roof on the building for some time. He reported that the slate, which was to cover the roof, had arrived. Keep in mind that the slate was not quarried nearby, the colonies being completely dependent on Great Britain for supplies. When it was delivered, 2/3 of the slate was broken and useless. And to add to the problem, Carey could not find the workmen who knew how to lay slate. Carey would instead be directed to use shingles for the roof. You can just hear the complaints of wastefulness during construction. That would have been the colonial version of our charges of waste, fraud, and abuse in today's government. Some things just never change. When the grandest house in town was complete, it hosted the grandest residents in Williamsburg with the grandest of balls and dinners. Birthday celebrations for the king and queen were special evenings. parties and balls during the holiday season were much anticipated, and the local papers noted the comings and goings of the social elite the same way they do today. Whether it was a dinner for 20 or a gathering for 200, parties at the palace were the most anticipated occasions of the day. Of course, such activity required a large household staff of both slaves and servants, and at any given time, you'd find at least 25 workers in and around the palace doing household chores, cooking, gardening, and seeing to every need of the family and guests. In 1770, the popular Governor Berkeley, who was known as the Baron de Baudetout, died in the palace. He would be replaced by John Murray, also known as Lord Dunmore. He didn't know it when he arrived here, but Lord Dunmore would be the final royal governor of Virginia and would preside over the colony during the years leading to the American Revolution. In many ways, but especially in personality and temperament, Lord Dunmore was the opposite of Governor Berkeley. Where Berkeley was accommodating and affable towards the House of Burgesses, Dunmore was difficult and a bumbler when it came to dealing with the upstart Burgesses. Dunmore had one major advantage, however, his wife. By all accounts, Lady Dunmore was beautiful and charming, and when she gave birth to a daughter, they named the baby Virginia. For a while, it was a love fest here in Williamsburg, but that love would not last as the winds of change blew throughout the colonies by the mid-1770s. Animosity between loyalists and patriots grew considerably worse in the months leading up to independence. And in one of his last ill-conceived actions as governor, Lord Dunmore seized the powder in the town magazine. This was not a smart move, political conditions being what they were by 1775. During the night of June 8, 1775, Dunmore took his family in the dead of night and left town. They would not return. Local newspapers mourned the departure of the wife, but not the husband. So what was to become of the household, especially the servants whose lives hung in the balance after the royal governor departed the premises? Well, everything in the house, including slaves and servants, was sold at auction in June 1776. Imagine what some of them must have felt, having served the governor's family for so long, and then suddenly having their livelihood and way of life completely upended. Add to that all of the talk of independence and individual rights, and some of the household staff, especially the enslaved staff, must have wondered where their rights were in all of this. That same month, June of 1776, the great patriot Patrick Henry would take up residence as the governor of Virginia. He would reside here during the 3 years of his service, and then in 1779, the new governor, Thomas Jefferson, would arrive with his family and his slaves, including the Hemings. They would reside here until the capital moved to Richmond in 1780. They moved out just in time. At the end of the Revolutionary War, the palace becomes a hospital for the wounded in the war. After all that activity, it would be great to tell you that the governor's palace is little changed from the years of the Revolution. Alas, that is not the case. Within a few months after the war ended, the palace also met its end in a massive fire that threatened the neighboring buildings. During the evening of December 22, 1781, the building burned to the ground. By the next morning, this stately home was a pile of rubble. Williamsburg would not see the likes of this building again until 1930, when it would be resurrected with the rest of the town. And lucky for the architects and builders, there were three sources of information to accurately rebuild the palace: the ruins of the building itself, a copperplate discovered in Oxford University's Bodleian Library, and a drawing by Thomas Jefferson. With the Governor's Palace, we come to the end of this tour of Williamsburg. You've heard many bits and pieces of information as we've made our way around the north side of town, so congratulations for making it through this fairly long trek. Remember that this is only part one of Bright Path Tours' two-part tour of this historic town. So far, you've only gotten half the story, so please join me again for part two, so that you can complete the picture of this colonial town during the era when the colonies and the colonists were just beginning to find their way to a life that few had dreamed would be within their reach. Thank you for downloading this tour. If you're staying for a few days, or if you plan to return, I hope you'll join Bright Path Tours again. Until then, I hope you'll enjoy the rest of your visit to Colonial Williamsburg.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.